The evidence suggests very strongly that the, quote, oil shortage, unquote, of 1979 was deliberately manufactured, that in fact there was plenty of gas available, but the tankers were being diverted in order to deliberately create an oil shortage in the United States, which in turn served to justify higher prices at the gas pump. It also contributed significantly to inflation and to the economic problems that the United States and other industrial nations experienced in the 1970s and 80s. Because if you increase the price of petroleum, you are going to experience across-the-board inflation, because every business uses petroleum either for heating and or transportation, and or the products that they use are transported and or manufactured by companies that use petroleum. Plus, people use fossil fuels, petroleum, natural gas, etc., for their own use. That's, I'm sure most of you drove getting here. People heat their homes in the winter with natural gas and or heating oil. So if you increase the price of oil, you are basically throwing a hand grenade into the economy, given the fact that we have not done very much at all to relieve our dependence on fossil fuels, with all of the resulting environmental damage that stems from that. But the fact of the matter is, if you want to throw a hand grenade into matters economic, if you want to cause problems for a country economically, and if you want to in turn discredit somebody politically, all you have to do is raise the price of oil. This results in massive inflation. Little people get hurt more than big people. Obviously, the tighter a budget one is on, then the less room there is in that budget for additional expenditures. You raise the price of oil, home heating oil, gasoline, you raise the cost of doing business across the board for all businesses, and you are going to cause serious, serious political problems. You're going to cause serious political problems for any industrial nation that is engaged in commercial activity. You're going to cause serious problems for individuals, and you're going to cause problems for the politicians who are running the countries that in turn are going to have to experience the consequences of the rise in oil prices. The available evidence suggests strongly that the phony oil estimates that the CIA under George Bush bequeathed the Carter administration were intended to serve as a justification for the raising of prices, the gas shortage, which not only served as the pretext for the U.S. military buildup under Ronald Reagan, but it also served as the vehicle, as the justification for what ultimately became the financial bankrupting of the United States. It's worth noting that the perceived need in 1980 to massively increase our defense spending was a combination of a couple of different things. One was the presumption that the United States was going to have to protect the Middle East from a Soviet military adventure because the Soviets were running out of oil. Well, that quite simply wasn't true. As I said, the Soviet Union in this time period was the world's largest oil producer and the world's second largest oil exporter behind Saudi Arabia. In addition, George Bush, when he was director of Central Intelligence, brought in a guy named Paul Nitze, last name N-I-T-Z-E, who was a longtime investment professional in Wall Street and Washington bigwig. Paul Nitze had been heavily involved with Dillon Reed and Company, the same company that employed William H. Draper Jr., the individual who specialized in investments in Nazi Germany, the same William H. Draper Jr. who was called upon by George Herbert Walker Bush when he was a congressman to provide expert testimony on why we had to hold down populations in third world countries, how vaccinating those populations is consistent with holding down the population is something people can ponder. If you're going to vaccinate them against disease, that's going to lead to an increase in population, unless, of course, there's something in the vaccinations which are going to lead people to have shorter lives or to preclude people from living at all. Paul Nitze was incorporated as the head of something called Team B, or something that became referred to as Team B. This was a team of supposed Soviet experts who drastically revised the estimates of Soviet military capabilities upward. There was all of a sudden, as a result of Paul Nitze, the Soviet Union was seen as being a much more formidable military power than previous estimates had gauged it as being. This dovetailed with the projection that the Soviet Union was going to have to move into the Middle East to gain a foothold on Middle East oil. And this was one of the things that led to the campaign rhetoric of 1980 and ultimately the policies of the Reagan and Bush administrations who in effect, tripled the national, not in effect, who tripled the national debt in 8 years. National debt was $900 billion approximately when Jimmy Carter left office. When Ronald Reagan left office 8 years later, it was $2.6 trillion. Roughly three times as much was spent. The deficits incurred under Ronald Reagan and were basically were 300% of the combined budget deficits from all the previous presidents, from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. When Rush Limbaugh and the other apologists for Reagan and Bush, when you bring that up with them, if you call one of their shows, they immediately blame it on the Democratic-controlled Congress, which is quite simply a lie. The Republicans had a majority in the Senate from 1980 through 1986, and they had a de facto majority in the House of Representatives with the so-called boll weevils, conservative Southern Democrats, many of whom have now become Republicans. The only reason they were still Democrats is they were still pissed at Lincoln because of the Civil War and freeing the slaves, and so they said they still held that against Nixon. But the Democrats did not control Congress. The Republicans controlled Congress and the White House, and one of the reasons why you have people like Rush Limbaugh and others dissembling is that the whole right-wing Republican wet dream was realized under Ronald Reagan and George Bush, and it wasn't some great fiscal savior. It resulted in debt, D-E-B-T. But the vehicle that ultimately brought about that debt was a combination of the Reagan tax cuts and the huge Reagan military buildup that was rationalized again by the presumption that the Soviets were much more powerful militarily than they actually were. This as a result of the Team B estimates when another member of the American power elite, Paul Nitze of Dillon Reed, was brought in by George Bush when he was director of the CIA to reevaluate Soviet military capabilities. And that again dovetailed with the drastically decreased estimates of Soviet oil production and the analysis that they were going to have to move into the Middle East served as the rationalization for the military buildup under Ronald Reagan. Ultimately, the inflation that bedeviled the American people under Jimmy Carter, as well as a combination of a couple of things, the gasoline crisis. I don't know how many of you remember in 1979 queuing up at the gas pumps for the last gas shortage. But a combination of the frustration that people felt because of that, the very real economic pain that was caused by the inflation that a rise in petroleum prices inevitably brings about. Please note that as you keep an eye on the stock market. I'm not saying necessarily that you're all a bunch of major investors, unlike Ralph Nader, who, by the way, is a multimillionaire and has millions of dollars in Wall Street investments. But there'll be one reason why he's running. He will be a major beneficiary of the George Bush tax cuts if, in fact, George Bush gets elected. Something to bear in mind. It should be noted that the increase in the price of oil in 1979 had a drastic effect on the average American pocketbook. It made it very, very difficult for Americans to get ahead because basically inflation was eating up profits. It was eating up the discretionary income and the disposable income that people were generating from their jobs, and it caused very real economic pain and very understandable political dissatisfaction with Jimmy Carter, albeit unjustified, because Jimmy Carter was one of the ones who was telling him, look, we've got to get away from this addiction to petroleum, we've got to start conserving energies, and he was trying to develop alternative energy sources. In vain, it turned out. Another thing that helped to deep-six Jimmy Carter as a as President of the United States was the hostage crisis in Tehran. After the U.S.-backed Shah was overthrown in 1979. Well, you know, when I talk about this stuff, which I remember very vividly, and I was already into my career as political war horse and analyst at this point, it makes me feel very old, because I remember this, and when I talk about Iran-Contra or the October surprise or the Iranian hostage crisis, these are things that I remember vividly, and I was on the air talking about at the time. Beloit College, which is a good Midwestern school, has a program where they familiarize their professors each fall with the sort of sphere of historical and political knowledge of the incoming freshman class. And the most recent prospectus, I guess you could say, that was developed for the faculty at Beloit College was talking about the incoming freshmen this fall, and that most of them had never heard of the Persian Gulf War. I mean, and other things that, this is not to be judgmental. I mean, they don't teach history now. Our media are not doing their job. But the Gulf War, that was just 9 years ago. That's like an immediate, to me, that's the immediate past. And yet, I find myself challenged when I'm talking to audiences. I think many of the people in this audience were of the age of consciousness at that time. When I talk about the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979, well, that is ancient history. You know, if people hadn't heard of the Persian Gulf War, I mean, that's scary. It's scary to contemplate what the powers that be are going to be able to do in the not too distant future to people who don't understand history. And if this is not to find fault with the kids who are being deprived in the school systems, but if you don't understand history, as I like to say on the program, if you don't study history, the world is a mystery, which I think is how they want it to be. They don't want people to understand what's going on. They want them to be presented with this vast, sort of swirling gas cloud of political mystery from which our pundits would divine those elements of concrete truth that are deemed essential for them to get by, such as George W. is a strong leader, right? And so they really should, he has a knowledge of the issues, and so that people should go out and vote for him. I mean, geez, scary thing. But that's something of an aside. And you think about it, an incoming college freshman now is 18. Gulf War took place when they were 9. And so, it's hard for me to remember when I was 18. It was like, we didn't have a passport. We had the Vietnam War to worry about at that point. But it's scary. If incoming college freshmen are unfamiliar with the Persian Gulf War, here I am as a public commentator referring offhandedly to the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979. I mean, I might as well be talking about the Punic Wars or the Peloponnesian Wars. I mean, that's ancient history. So if during the course of this talk, if at some point I take a little bit of time to explain something that it might appear a little pedantic, it's just because I'm increasingly self-conscious about the meaning of a few of these gray hairs I've got upstairs here. And I try not to take too much for granted. At the same time, when I talk about the U.S. capitalization of Hitler or the Kennedy assassination or many of the things that I've necessarily had to refer to glancingly, I can't take the time to go into that in as much detail. Yet it's scary when you set forth a political heritage of the Bush family. They're involved in so many different things. But when I'm thinking about the younger generation now doesn't know about the Persian Gulf War, I'm definitely going to have to proceed with caution, and I think that perhaps some of my pedantry under the circumstances is warranted under the circumstances. But in any event, the hostage crisis was set, it appears to have been deliberately manipulated. When the U.S.-backed Shah was turned from power, the Iranian militants, Islamic fundamentalists, seized the United States Embassy in Tehran and held 52 hostages for a period of about, let's see, it was November of 79 through January of 1981. They were released within hours of Ronald Reagan's taking office. Now, this is another of the events that could be the focal point of an entire lecture. It is the focal point of one major archive show, RFA 31, which talks about the October surprise. Farah Mansour, a member of the Iranian resistance, has developed some very compelling research suggesting that the actual taking of the hostages was arranged in conjunction with the Reagan-Bush elements of the U.S. national security establishment. So that, according to Farah Mansour, the entire hostage crisis was deliberately arranged by the Reagan-Bush forces. I would note that Mehdi Karoubi, who's now the moderate, quote-unquote, speaker of the Iranian parliament, was one of the alleged contact people for the October surprise, and certainly his brother, Haroun Karoubi, was one of the key people involved with the Iran-Contra machinations, and we're going to talk about that in a second. But suffice it to say that the hostage crisis in which 52 American diplomats and Marines and spies, in all likelihood CIA officers, were taken prisoner by the Iranians and who then humiliated the United States. This was something which was very useful politically to the American right, the Reagan and Bush administration in particular, or the Reagan and Bush campaign. By the way, remember, being managed by William Casey, okay? The same William Casey was handling the International Rescue Committee's machinations to bring in a lot of these people that we looked at in connection with the Crusade for Freedom. William Casey is managing the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign. George Bush initially was running for the Republican nomination. He did not get the nomination. Ronald Reagan, who was the chief spokesperson for the Crusade for Freedom, got the nomination, and he became the official standard bearer with George Bush, former director of Central Intelligence, and a member of this networking operation that we're looking at as his vice president. His campaign director, was William Casey, who then went on to become director of Central Intelligence. But the humiliation that the American people felt over the Iranian hostage crisis was another of the factors that led them to vote Jimmy Carter out of office, as well as their dissatisfaction with the high price of gas, waiting on lines at the gas pump, and the inflation that resulted from the increase in gas prices. And bear in mind that it appears that that gas crisis was deliberately manufactured. Now bear that in mind, of course, because the notion of a gas crisis, the notion of fuel shortages, of the possible economic impact of the rising price of petroleum, this is not something that is irrelevant to us today. Obviously, I'm speaking somewhat tongue-in-cheek. Obviously, that's exactly what's on the front burner today, pun intended. And I suspect that the rise in petroleum prices is not an accident. I may be wrong, but I am very suspicious about the extent to which the entire scenario that we're looking at, bear in mind, in 1979, is now being repeated 21 years later. There is serious concern on the part of investors that a combination of the weak euro, perhaps some point I'll lecture about the European Monetary Union. People may remember my forecasts about the euro, what effect it would have on the U.S. economy, i.e. bad, and that it would probably be a weak currency. It is very weak. And combination of the euro, its deleterious impact on U.S. exports, manufacturing exports, the rising price of petroleum, and the final coming to the senses over the dot-com nonsense is threatening the stock market. Everybody's been wowed about the 10-year bull market and 10-year bull market, and we're worried about when this is going to end. And now there is serious concern about a stock market collapse, or that the market will turn down, and that this in turn might be decisive in the current presidential election. Bear that in mind. Bear in mind too that in 1979, as George Bush is challenging Ronald Reagan for the Republican nomination, unsuccessfully, he then becomes vice president. I suspect that he was the power behind the throne all along, but bear in mind that his son, George W., we have finally gotten to George W., is running unsuccessfully for Congress in Texas. And one of the main pillars of his platform for his congressional campaign, unsuccessful, was the need to decontrol the price of oil in order to stimulate petroleum production. Surprise, surprise. Now, George W., who followed his father and grandfather into Skull and Bones, George W. is a member of that networking fraternity, George W. was at this point already involved in the oil business, like his father. He followed George Herbert Walker Bush into the oil business. His first oil company, manifestly unsuccessful, was called Arbusto Energy. Arbusto is the Spanish word for Bush. Arbusto, bear in mind, was begun in part from capital from James R. Bath. That's the guy who claims he was recruited into the CIA by George Bush Sr., and that at George Bush Sr.'s instructions, he became involved with Saudi business clients, one of whom was the family of Osama bin Laden. And bear in mind, too, that James R. Bath got involved with BCCI and also became an aircraft broker by his own account, as at the request of George Herbert Walker Bush. In 1979, George W. Bush is heading up Arbusto, which is jokingly referred to by associates in the petroleum industry as Arbusto, because they kept drilling dry wells. It was very unsuccessful. Nonetheless, though, George W. Bush continued to find benefactors. Another of the people that helped to underwrite his business dealings was none other than William H. Draper III. Now, that's the son of William H. Draper Jr., the Dylan Reed guy who helped to invest in Nazi Germany and who was called in by George Herbert Walker Bush to give expert testimony on the need to hold down populations in the Third World. This, as we're beginning to vaccinate Third World populations, which is a strange way of holding down populations. But bear in mind that George W. at this point is also running for political office. He is also in the oil industry, and he is running, surprise, surprise, on a platform that emphasizes the need to decontrol the price of oil and stimulate petroleum production. And of course, at the national and international level at this same time, there is an ostensible petroleum shortage. Gas prices are going through the roof with the resulting economic and social dislocation that comes from that. And people are queuing up at the gas pumps, getting extremely dissatisfied with Jimmy Carter because he can't provide them with cheap, fast gas so they can climb in their cars and drive over to Lake Tahoe and go gambling or whatever. And at the same time, them Iranians were holding U.S. hostages taken from the embassy. And the evidence suggests very strongly that the Reagan and Bush campaign was colluding with the, was in collusion with the Iranians to deliberately withhold the hostages until after Jimmy Carter's political humiliation and election defeat were assured. That the hostage crisis did help to humiliate Jimmy Carter and to defeat him. And the evidence suggests very strongly that, in fact, the Reagan-Bush campaign was deeply involved with the Khomeini forces in Iran. There was an abortive desert rescue mission, and one of the people involved with helping to plan this, it was manifestly unsuccessful, was Richard Secord, who, as it turned out, ultimately was one of the principal figures in the Iran-Contra affair. In the 1980 campaign, one of the mini-scandals that emerged, it later on got investigated, but not to the extent that it should have, but it was something called Debategate. It turned out that when they were rehearsing for their one debate, Ronald Reagan's camp had briefing papers from Jimmy Carter's preparation team for the debate. And this was seen as constituting something of a political espionage. What didn't get the publicity do it when the Debategate scandal was investigated was that the Reagan-Bush campaign, in addition to having secret briefing papers from Jimmy Carter, they also had secret documents that had been taken from the U.S. Embassy by the Iranian militants when they seized the hostages. Where did they get those? How did the Reagan-Bush campaign come to be in possession of those? Again, bear in mind who we're looking at. We're looking at Ronald Reagan, who was the spokesperson for the Crusade for Freedom, George Bush, deeply involved with that whole milieu, the same George Bush who had incorporated them as a formal wing of the Republican Party when he was head of the Republican National Committee, and you've got William Casey as head of the campaign. Jimmy Carter was eventually defeated. Within hours of Ronald Reagan's nomination, the hostages were released, and we now know that this was the beginning of a long relationship between the Iranian Islamic fundamentalists, one of the, quote, terrorist nations, unquote, that we heard so much about in the 1980s, and the Reagan and Bush administration. One of the things that I find very interesting in terms of understanding the not understanding, but illustrating the Bush family legacy, the legacy to which George W. was heir, is understand the shooting of Ronald Reagan in March of 1981. Ronald Reagan was shot allegedly, this is on March 30th of 1981. He was allegedly shot by John Hinckley Jr. John Hinckley Jr. was a member of a prominent family, originally from Dallas, Texas, and later Denver, Colorado. They were involved with, surprise, surprise, the oil industry. They had an independent oil company, Vanderbilt Energy. John Hinckley Sr. had been a major contributor to George Bush's primary campaign when he was challenging Ronald Reagan for the nomination in 1980. John Hinckley Sr. had also been deeply involved with World Vision, a Christian missionary organization which, according to report, has served as a front for U.S. intelligence, specifically the CIA, in both Central America and in Southeast Asia. Of course, George Bush had been director of the CIA. John Hinckley Sr. had been contributing to George Bush's campaign when he was challenging Reagan for the nomination. Scott Hinckley, his son, and the brother of John Hinckley Jr. was scheduled to have dinner with Neil Bush the night after the shooting. They were going to discuss, surprise, surprise, an oil deal, because Neil Bush was an attorney with Amoco, Standard Oil of Indiana. Another member of the Hinckley family was dating another member of the Bush family. John Hinckley Jr. had been arrested at Nashville Airport when Jimmy Carter was expected the previous fall. He had two guns, 50-odd, it might have been three guns, actually, at least two guns, I'd have to check the record, 50-odd rounds of ammunition. He had a pair of handcuffs. He was then arrested and held on something like six. He was released on a bail of something like $6.50, which is quite inexpensive. If you're caught at an airport with two guns and 50-odd rounds of ammunition, with the president do, you're unlikely to ever see the light of day again. You're sure not going to get out on $66, might have been $60 bail. I mean, something ridiculously low. Anyway, he walked after that, and he was a former member of the American Nazi Party, specifically the National Socialist White People's Party. They kicked him out because they thought he was a government agent. This was the same American Nazi Party that had been founded by George Lincoln Rockwell, whose Arlington, Virginia name, address, and phone number were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest. He even bought the gun that he allegedly used to shoot Reagan at a pawn shop on Elm Street in Dallas, which is the street on which President Kennedy was riding when he was killed. I suspect that from the forensics that Hinckley was a diversion. He was firing into the crowd, and that the real bullet that was put into Reagan was put in from a marksman standing off to his side. But it certainly served to, I suspect, send a message to Ronald Reagan about who was really in power. And of course, bear in mind that Vice President was George Bush, former CIA director. Good for the Hinckley and Bush family are very close. And that if anything had happened to Ronald Reagan, of course, George Bush becomes President of the United States. Later on, Hinckley was represented by the Edward Bennett Williams Law Firm, one of the preeminent Washington law firms. Its previous clients included Richard Helms, Director of CIA, John Connally, former Governor of Texas and Secretary of the Navy, and Secretary of the Treasury, Jimmy Hoffa. Very, very powerful law firm. Edward Bennett Williams had owned the Baltimore Orioles and the Washington Redskins. And you don't just hire Edward Bennett Williams to straighten out a traffic ticket. And he's not generally, it's not generally the sort of law firm that takes on charity cases. But they represented John Hinckley Jr. And Hinckley got off with a relative wrist slap. He's interned in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. And relatively happy and hale and hearty for somebody that took a pot shot at the President of the United States. It's also interesting that whereas Hinckley's Nazi connections and sympathies were well known, that by the time Hinckley came to trial, it was said that he was delusional and he imagined himself as the head of a white supremacist organization, the American Front. Well, the American Front is a real organization. It's headed up by Tom Metzger. And so it's not an imaginary organization, but when you have Edward Bennett Williams employees as your counsel, it can work wonders. But it's very interesting to me to watch how the media, you talk about power and you talk about its administration, press coverage is very, very important. And I don't think you have to be Lieutenant Columbo to figure out what in all likelihood underlay the shooting of President Reagan. A message was being sent. I suspect that if they'd really wanted Reagan out of the way, they'd have used a larger caliber weapon. But certainly I think at that point Ronald Reagan got the message. But George Herbert Walker Bush, again, former director of Central Intelligence, oil industry professional, was he wore a number of different hats early on in the administration. One of the most important of those hats was as the chairman of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. In this regard, Bush oversaw a task force and basically got to craft some recommendations. One of the things that came out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism was a series of interagency governmental networks that were ostensibly to combat terrorism, but which in point of fact appear to have been used by George Bush as his own private intelligence agency, and which in turn were used to effect the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate machinations against the will of and without the knowledge of Congress. After Congress cut off aid to the Contras, a number of different ploys were undertaken by the Reagan-Bush administration to keep the Contra war going, and the aid to the Contras was administered through these interagency governmental networks. Elements of State Department, CIA, Pentagon, Justice, and so forth were coordinated, and basically they were crafted as George Bush's private intelligence service and used not only for the arming of the Contras and the attendant drug traffic, but also were used for the arming of Saddam Hussein. So at this point, the Iranians were locked into a brutal and bitter war for some 8 years' duration, the Iraq-Iran war. And at that time, we were seen as needing to tilt toward Iraq, which was a major oil, both major oil producers. Iraq was the smaller of the two countries and was seen as the probable loser. And so in order to punish the Islamic militants, it turned out we were in bed with the very same Islamic militants the whole time, it was seen as necessary to arm Saddam Hussein. Well, eventually, of course, we were also arming the Iranians, as we saw. In the 1980s, anti-terrorism was the watchword, or counter-terrorism. The three main terrorist-supporting nations that we were told we had to watch out for were Libya, Iran, and Iraq. Turned out all three are major oil-producing nations, and in turn, in the form of the Turple Wilson operations, we were actively supporting Gaddafi and his terrorist cadre. With the Iranian weapon sales, we were supporting the Iranians, and with the Iraqgate machinations, we were selling arms to Saddam Hussein as well. All three of these, quote, terrorist nations, unquote, not that they didn't engage in terrorism, just happened to be major petroleum-producing countries, and it turned out that we were in bed with all three of them, the whole bloody time. Nonetheless, though, we had to combat terrorism. And so in order to do that, George Bush rode to the front and chaired the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. The recommendations coming out of that set up interagency governmental networks utilized by George Bush as sort of a White House within a White House, sort of a government within a government. At the same time, George Bush was chairing the Vice President's Task Force on Financial Deregulation. They deregulated the savings and loan industry, and considerable portions of the savings and loan industry appear to have been not only deliberately looted by organized crime in the intelligence community, but specifically some of those funds were diverted in order to help finance the Contra War. And George Bush, again, was head of the Financial Task Force on Deregulation. One of the savings and loans that was looted was the Silverado savings and loan, and many of the bad loans that were that brought down Silverado, later bailed out by the U.S. taxpayer, were approved by Neil Bush. And at the same time, George Bush was heading up the South Florida Task The South Florida Anti-Drug Task Force, that was its formal name. This was a task force, yet another task force, which was gonna, interdict all the drugs that were coming into South Florida. And of course, if you're gonna do that, then George Bush is just the man that you want heading up your anti-drug interdiction effort in South Florida. The evidence suggests very strongly that all three of these hats, the head of the Financial Task Force on Deregulation, the point man for the South Florida Anti-Drug Task Force, and the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism were in fact vehicles for basically unleashing George Bush and the intelligence community to conduct covert operations at will against the knowledge of, or without the knowledge of, or even against the explicit will of Congress. Because again, the networks set up by the Vice President's Task Force were used to affect not only the Iranian weapons sales, but the aid to the Contras. Much of the drugs that were going into South Florida, as it turns out, were being trafficked with the collusion of the elements of U.S. intelligence and the Contras and George Bush and the elements underneath him. And it appears that some of the financial institutions that were deregulated were deliberately looted in order to finance the Contra War. So again, George Bush is wearing some very interesting hats in the early 1980s, and it would appear that his longtime status as a covert operator ultimately spawned the hats that he was wearing at this time. It's worth noting that the Iran-Contra affair is not something that we hear very much about it. We were told that this is a minor scandal and this, that, and the other thing. On the other hand, when, you know, Bill Clinton gets a blowjob from Monica Lewinsky, that's a major scandal. But the Iran-Contra affair, which entailed active support for terrorist nations, appears to have entailed massive collusion with regard to the drug trade. From a constitutional standpoint, it constituted treason and a direct formal negation of the U.S. Constitution. War-making powers are allocated to Congress by the Constitution. Only the Congress has the power to declare war, and only Congress has the power to make appropriations, except in certain emergency circumstances. And Congress voted to cut off aid to the Contras, and the Reagan-Bush administration basically thumbed its nose at the Constitution and the law and basically said, up yours. We are going to support the Contras whether you want us to or not. Some of the drug trafficking took place in connection with that. The lootings of the savings and loans, some of that took place in connection with that. The utilization of these anti-terrorist networks was actually to support terrorists, not only right-wing Latin American terrorists, the Contras, but the very, quote, Middle Eastern terrorists, unquote, we were told we had to watch out for. So Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the hated Iranians who had held our hostages, and it turns out we were selling both sides weapons in the Iran-Iraq war. And, of course, Gaddafi. Most of the people here were at the age of consciousness. You may remember the blitzkrieg that took place with regard to Gaddafi and his terrorist cadre. I remember in late 81 and early 82, we were told that Libyan hit squads had entered the United States from Mexico and were going to possibly attempt to assassinate American officials, including the President of the United States. Well, it turned out there were no Libyan hit squads at all. I mean, it's just a complete figment of the popular press imagination, but they had huge concrete barriers up in the streets of Washington, D.C., leading up to the White House. Turned out there were no Libyan hit squads, and if there had been Libyan hit squads, in all likelihood they would have been trained by Wilson and Turpel and Shackley and Kleins and the other people that we'd sent out to collaborate with this terrorist cadre in the first place. It's worth noting that after Congress cut off aid to the Contras, and the Reagan and Bush administrations then explicitly negated the constitutional authority with their actions, one of the things that took place was the utilization of quid pro quo, that's plural, in order to get foreign countries to clandestinely ship arms to the Contras. One of the clandestine weapons shipments was a shipment of SA-7 missiles. These are shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles, which were seen as being needed by the Contras in order to combat Soviet-supplied military helicopters, Soviet-supplied attack helicopters. But these SA-7 missiles were obtained from the People's Republic of China, and they were clandestinely shipped to the Contras through Latin America. And a quid pro quo was set up where the Chinese were quite happy to frustrate Soviet ambitions or perceived Soviet ambitions in Central America. And in turn, they would experience, quote, better relations, unquote, with the United States. And one of the quid pro quo, again, plural, that was set up in order to illegally supply the Contras was, again, a shipment of missiles that came from the People's Republic of China was sent to the Contras. And in turn, in the 1980s, a program of a cooperation between the United States, between American scientists and Chinese scientists was set up with regard to sharing information about nuclear weapons. And one of the scientists who was liaising with the Chinese scientists in this period under this program, and who in turn appears to have been directed by the CIA, was none other than Wen Ho Lee, the fellow who was just finally acquitted after having been held in solitary confinement for 9 months. Basically, his defense counsel presented very credible information to the judge that not only was he not guilty of espionage and of treason, but beyond that, his activities were being overseen by the Central Intelligence Agency. Nonetheless, Judge Parker, a Reagan appointee, lambasted the Clinton administration and the Energy Department under Bill Richardson and everything and everybody else, but in all likelihood, the people who were actually responsible, who were George Bush, the Reagan administration, and the Central Intelligence Agency itself, because again, Wen Ho Lee's activities were being overseen by CIA. Beyond that, the W-88 warhead that the Chinese came into possession of is utilized by other countries as well. The French and the British utilize the W-88 miniaturized warhead. There's no indication, first of all, that espionage was necessarily involved in the Chinese procurement of this weapon, and there sure as hell is no indication whatsoever that Wen Ho Lee, by the way, born in Taiwan, was in any way involved in espionage against the United States. On the contrary, and there's a pun there, the evidence suggests that his involvement with Chinese nuclear scientists was part of the quid pro quo that was set up under the Contra support effort when the Chinese made SA-7 missiles were channeled to the Contras, and this was being done under the watch, under the auspices of George Herbert Walker Bush, George W.'s father. And of course, the Wen Ho Lee case has surfaced proving that, ostensibly proving that the Clinton administration is lax with regard to security, that they have not been keeping up the American national security considerations, and that in fact the intimation has been that they've been swapping Chinese campaign money for nuclear secrets. Well, that all turned out to have been a crock. It weakened the Department of Energy right at a time when oil prices are spiking, when Clinton had been turning to the Department of Energy to try to find some solution to reining in escalating price of petroleum, and it also weakened Bill Richardson, who was seen as being a potential vice presidential candidate for Al Gore, because Bill Richardson is a native California, I guess he's really a native of New Mexico, but he's Latino, and he was seen as possibly representing a boon in this regard, in that it could boost Democratic political fortunes in the growing Latino community in the United States. Also, as a result of the propaganda directed against the Department of Energy, a new security division has been set up inside of the Department of Energy to oversee nuclear weapons, and a former deputy director of Central Intelligence has been installed as the head of this agency. Keep an eye on that one. It'll be interesting to see eventually what develops. But do note that some of the some of the things that were developing in the 1980s appear to have tracked directly up through the 90s and are now manifesting themselves in the year 2000 campaign, such as Wen-Ho Lee, whose persecution, and I think that's an appropriate term, has been used to attack the Clinton administration, to attack the Energy Department, to neutralize Bill Richardson as a potential vice presidential candidate, and also to alienate Asian Americans from the Clinton administration, because Judge Parker was very explicit in attacking the Clinton administration as on the subject of the Wen-Ho Lee case. Bear in mind that Judge Parker was appointed by Ronald Reagan. Bear in mind that in this same time period, the largest U.S. covert operation is taking place in Southwest Asia. It is in support of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. This is taking place through Pakistan. And that one of the people who is very active as an anti-Soviet combatant being run by U.S. intelligence in Afghanistan at this period is Osama bin Laden, a native of Saudi Arabia and an individual whose family may very well have put up a portion of the investment capital that went to start up Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first energy company. That if, in fact, the people who knew James R. Bath's analysis is correct, which is that James R. Bath didn't have any money of his own to invest in Arbusto Energy. It's worth noting, ultimately, that the Contras went down. Obviously, they were not... The Sandinistas, however, went down. Ultimately, the Contra War was successful. And George Bush in 1988 ran on the Republican ticket. Now this brings us up in a sense to the, well actually before I jump to 88, I should fill in a couple more details about some of the other activities of the Bush family vis-a-vis the Contra War. Two of the scandals that emerged in connection with the Contra War, one of them was the Sunflow case. And the Sunflow case was a company in Colorado that was developed, supposedly to develop and market a dehydrator which could dehydrate produce and get it to market in the Third World and as a result alleviate Third World starvation. Two of the people involved with generating funding for Sunflow were a black Republican named Arthur Fletcher and another fellow named Neil Bush. Now it turns out that the whole Sunflow dehydrator marketing case was a scam. It never materialized, and it appears, the evidence suggests, it was actually used in order to generate money for the Central American cocaine trade, and some of the same names have cropped up in connection with the Sunflow investigation as cropped up in connection with the so-called Southern Front being operated in support of the Contra War in Costa Rica. And one of the main names, again, involved with the Sunflow case, Neil Bush. In this same time period, Jeb Bush, who has become governor of Florida, has been acting as George Herbert Walker Bush's liaison to the anti-Castro Cuban community in Florida. They, in turn, have been very active on behalf of the Contra War. And another of the people that Jeb Bush was interfacing with in this time period was a guy named Miguel Riqueri, a Cuban-American who, in turn, is very closely connected not only to the Contra support effort, but also to Cuban-American gangsters associated with the Lansky Traficante syndicate. In particular, Riqueri was quite close to Santos Traficante, the mob boss of Tampa, another of the people that was involved with the drug intelligence organized crime milieu that stretches from the anti-Castro efforts of the late 1950s and 60s right on up through the Contra War in the 1980s. Traficante died in 87. Jeb Bush was also very active in this time period on behalf of Orlando Bosch, the head of CORU. That's the anti-Castro Cuban terrorist organization that was part of the Internacional Fascista. Orlando Bosch had been interned for his role in blowing up a Cuban airliner, and Jeb Bush was very active on behalf of trying to win Orlando Bosch his freedom. At the same time, a scandal developed in connection with an outfit called Covenant House. Covenant House was a home for orphaned boys headed up by Father Bruce Ritter. They had also been heavily involved in Central America and were allegedly involved with intelligence activities. Whether or not that's true, I cannot state, but what it can be stated is that when Father Ritter got himself involved in and alleged, well, I shouldn't say the scandal was real enough. He was charged with child molestation. He was allegedly molesting a lot of the boys who were in his care. The Hill and Knowlton Public Relations Firm, one of the most powerful public relations firms in Washington, D.C. They were the people who handled the PR on behalf of the Kuwaiti government in the Gulf War. They were founded by Robert Keith Gray, one of the top Republican kingmakers in Washington, D.C. Hill and Knowlton went to the aid of Father Bruce Ritter when he was charged with child molestation. Covenant House had been very closely and actively supported by Prescott Bush Jr., who was involved with an outfit called AmeriCares. Now, this is not Prescott Bush Sr., this is Prescott Bush Jr., the brother of George Herbert Walker Bush and George W.'s uncle. And his name emerged in connection with the scandal surrounding Covenant House and AmeriCares. Not that not that Prescott Jr. was ever linked to child molestation, but one of his cronies was charged with that. And the way that the wheels of power seemed to turn on behalf of Father Ritter and Covenant House,